Welcome, everybody, to another extraordinary episode of Podcasting Them Softly. I'm Frank, and I'm joined with my BFF, Nick. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great. What's going on, bud?
Not much. This is exciting because we have a returning guest. We have my former film professor, Francine Sanders, here on the show today. Hello, Francine. Welcome back.
Hi. How are you?
Doing well. I suppose we're going to build this the Francine Files. I think we kicked that around the last couple times. Okay. Well, you guys laughed, so I think I'm just going to roll with that then.
Cool.
Last time we had Francine on, we talked about, or I should say we gushed about Michael Mann's Thief, because that's a film the three of us absolutely adore, and we kind of glossed over Michael Mann's filmography a little bit as well. Today, we're going to be discussing Alan Pakula's Flute, starring Donald Sutherland, Jane Fonda, and Roy Scheider. And this is a film that I saw for the first time when I took Francine's class, Studies of the Films of the 1970s, probably 10 years ago. Might have been a little longer, 11 maybe. So I had not seen this film since I took Francine's class, and I watched it twice recently, and I'm very excited to talk about this film. I know both of you have watched it numerous times, a lot more than I have.
Well, I'm excited that we're going back to a film that we saw in my 70s class that you took, and that it's going to be interesting for me just to hear what it was like watching it again after all this time.
Yeah, and I'm quite anxious to discuss it. In general, I am a big fan of Alan Pakula's films. I think that he's probably one of the more underrated, least celebrated auteurs, maybe even you could call him that, certainly with his paranoia films from the 70s. I think that he's just one of those great filmmakers from the 70s, 80s era that just never got the full due that he was, I think, deserved. Tragically, obviously, he died, I think, well before he would have stopped making movies, which is a shame. So I'm excited that we finally get to talk about, one of his great films, truly great films with Clute, if not maybe some more of the stuff on his resume, because I think he's kind of like an Arthur Hiller in a way, like sort of this unassuming guy that had this amazing filmography of movies that stretched a lot of different genres, but never got quite the same recognition or the clout is some of his other contemporaries.
You know, it's interesting, and maybe be just because I'm older. I think I've always seen him get recognition, but you're right, probably not as much as he deserves. I was thinking about when I was watching the film again, because I too watched it again, even though I've seen it, a fair amount of times, that, he started off as a producer. And I think it was kind of an exciting thing just to remember that he produced To Kill a Mockingbird. And I just, maybe a lot of people recognize films that he produced. And I think perhaps you're right that you don't realize, he gets associated a lot with All the President's Men. I think a lot of people just connect with All the President's Men and don't maybe understand, as you said, the scope of his career.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly think that people have given, and I'm not saying he didn't get credit. He was Oscar nominated. He won awards. For some reason, I don't feel like people talk about him with the same sort of reverence as they do, Coppola, Scorsese, some of these other people that came from that similar time period. And I think a lot of people just think of him as the All the President's Men guy, when there's so many other great movies that he was responsible for. But this is definitely one of the top films for him, and certainly a movie that, was really, it's a layered movie. I mean, it's a film that operates on so many different levels. Not the least of which is that it's a great study in noir. It's also this like sort of feminist picture as well in a weird way. And then you have like procedural elements and, sort of like this like reverse love story in a way. And, I just think it's so worthy of revisiting. It's a rich movie. You don't get movies like this made very often anymore.
No, you're right. And I don't know when we're officially going to talk about any things related to it. I mean, we're just diving in. But everything that just will go here. But I was going to say, one of the great things, not that you guys need any PR, but one of the great things about doing, you know, this podcast with you guys is watching the movie again with me thinking ahead, like, okay, we're going to do this hour-long talk. And it sort of puts me in this great frame of mind to look at some things that maybe I might not have looked at before. And one of the things I was noticing just watching it again twice recently, you know, and maybe because I was knew that we were going to talk about the Poole's filmography a bit too, just kind of thinking about him, like you said, as an auteur, you know, through his body of work. There's this tremendous humanity. You know, even a film like this, which for all those, you know, elements that you describe, you know, I think I've used it also in conspiracy thriller classes that I've taught. I think you had it in, Frank, in my 70s class, but I've taught conspiracy thriller courses where I've used it. You know, and I think of it as a thriller, but, I think, or maybe just a thriller class, I should say, but there's such a humanity in it. There's such tremendous characterization in it that just blows my mind, along with all the other great things we're going to talk about. But that's what I was kind of being reminded of as I prepared for this.
Yeah, my initial reaction for not having seen it in so long was I absolutely loved it, and it was like watching the film for the first time. And I know I spoke to both of you prior about this, but I found myself, when the film was over, I found myself questioning what the film was about, because it's about so many different things, and the film is so brooding, and it simmers the entire time, and as you're watching this film unravel, more and more secrets are coming out, to the point where it just becomes very mind-boggling.
Yeah, I love that question, just that, you know, I think that's a question that one of the things that makes 70s films so exciting to me, and I'm sure to you guys, and one of the reasons I always love teaching a 70s class and wish I could teach it, like, next week, is the ambiguity in those films. You know, it was so exciting to see this, you know, period of filmmaking where things were not, I mean, it's more commonplace now, but it wasn't then. And to see this group of films emerge where there's endings where you are sort of wondering, what the fuck was this about? You know, right?
Yeah, no, yeah. Clued is not an easy movie to distill in one viewing, and it's not, it treads moral ambiguity all throughout. It presents flawed characters as your protagonist. It does all those great things that movies in the 70s, you know, really got into, and the kind of stuff that sort of lost its way, with, you know, few modern, you know, exceptions. You know, there's so many ways you can go at it. One of the things that has always really struck me about the movie are the visual aesthetics. Obviously, Gordon Willis, the cinematographer, numerous collaborations with Alan Pakula, and I feel that this movie is just one of the most just beautifully dark looking movies. I mean, there's a big difference, I think, between underlighting a set and then calling it dark and then actually like painting with darkness, which is pretty much what Gordon Willis did throughout his entire career. I mean, he, you know, earned the nickname Prince of Darkness, if I'm not mistaken. This movie is just so incredible to look at. There are different shades of black, brown, and gray all throughout. And I think that not only is it interesting to look at visually just for your eyes, but the, you know, the color scheme, the atmosphere that this movie evokes, it is really, linked up very well to the characters and to their motivations.
I love what you just said. And one of the things you said earlier was that it had a noirish, quality to it. And, you know, of course, I love noir. You guys have discussed that. Noir is, you know, I mean, one of my favorite anythings. I think part of that noir quality, which, you know, we normally think black and white and grays, you know, you do get that. You get that through the color, but through the darkness, you know, those shades of brown, And the darkness isn't just, it's not just, you know, dark visually. It's underscoring, as the best noir does for me, the content, you know, what's going on. Things aren't being what they seem to be, you know, the confusion, just all of that that comes with noir that we get through that cinematography here. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I absolutely love the noir quality to this film because not only does it look lived in throughout the duration of the film, but it's also the archetypal setup of the detective played by Donald Sutherland, the mysterious slash dangerous woman that's played by Jane Fonda, and then the rich and powerful man,
right.
Who's played by Charles Coffey, I think is his last name. Everyone goes Coffey.
Yeah, yes. I think it's Cioffi, or I don't know how you would pronounce it. It's Charles Cioffi.
Right. His table, yes.
Mm-hmm. And then you get the, I don't know what you would really describe Roy Scheider's character as. He's not really the antagonist, but he's, I guess, a sub-antagonist in the film.
Yeah.
He's the equal parts dangerous man that shows up, which I just want to interject real quick. I know, the funny thing was, is Roy Scheider's one of my favorite actors, and I always try and watch everything that I can find that he's been in. Some of the stuff's harder to find than others, but, when I was watching the credits, the opening credits, I was like, oh, like Roy Scheider's in this. I totally forgot. I don't remember who he plays. He's got to play a John or somebody that Donald Sutherland interviews. And I totally forgot that he's the pimp. And he's so sleazy and terrible in the movie. And,
Doesn't he feel like brothers with Sport, Harvey Keitel?
Oh,
and
yeah.
Driver? Like, feel like they're like in the same block.
Yeah, the white scuzzy pimp that's in the 70s movies. And he's got the facial scar and everything. I mean, I don't think he's been as menacing in anything else other than maybe Eric Red's film that we both love. What is it, Nick?
Conan Tate.
Even though his character's a lot more sympathetic in that film. But, yeah, I love the menace and the doom that his character oozed with the sleaziness quality.
Well, you know, thinking about it, now that you bring it up this way, since the real antagonist, I mean, you know, there's multiple conflicts going on, obviously, but if you think about, you know, Cioffi or Coffey's character, Cable, you know, being the main antagonist, the problem, you know, in terms of giving, Clint something to fight against, He's kind of an invisible antagonist because we don't really know who we know, but he doesn't know. We know, you know, far earlier than Clint knows that he's the bad guy. And so, in a way, Scheider's character gives Clint some tangible, concrete, monster to work against. What do you think, right? Does that sort of make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so, like, you know, and then there's that whole kind of internal journey to this, you know, the romantic, which to me, I really want to get into. I mean, I think that relationship between Clint and Bree is just incredible. And I think that's what excites me probably the most about this film. But I think that's where Scheider really comes in, his character, Frank, comes in to play there because he really forces Clute to take action and show his feelings toward Bree in a big way, in a very visceral way. So I love that. I love that.
Yeah, and it's an interesting, you know, and it's very interesting performance on the part of Donald Sutherland because it's a subdued performance. There isn't a performance in the movie that ever went over the top. Everything felt very, everything feels very believable. It feels very reined in, if you will. But I feel like any other actor might have approached, and obviously there's a lot to be said about Pakula's direction, but, I feel like other actors might have looked at this role in a different way, possibly that wasn't on the page necessarily. And I just think that there's such a unique, understated quality to Donald Sutherland in this film, and it's almost like I can't even put words on it. It's just,
yeah.
And his general air sort of runs right into the relationship that he developed, that develops between him and Jane Fonda.
Yeah, his performance is somewhere between sheepish and stoic. It's very interesting because he spends a significant portion of the film watching and observing. And he interacts, but he does it silently. And every time we see him in the film, he's not saying anything. He's doing all of his acting through his eyes. And it's not even like he's doing facial expressions. It's just, it's so unique. And I hate to use this as an example, a contemporary film, but I find it, very akin to Gary Oldman and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Gary Oldman is just put into the film to watch, and we're watching the film through him. And I can't get over how great Donald Sutherland is in this film. I've always thought he was a very, very good actor. And I love how he is just so silent throughout the film. And I think he and Jane Fonda is just fucking remarkable in this movie. I think that they play off of each other so well, and the way that their characters develop. There's nothing rushed about, like, as you were saying, Francine, about the inevitable love story. There's nothing that's forced or rushed. It's a slow burn.
Well, yeah, and I think, this is a film where, like I say, one would certainly think of, I think of Capool, I think of President's Men, I think of the Parallax View is one of my all-time favorite 70s films.
Me too.
Yeah, and those, the suspense, the thriller elements, in those films in particular, the conspiracy elements. But here you've got thriller, you've got those elements, but you've got this incredible sort of core, character building stuff going on. And like you say, Frank, you just mentioned this kind of slow sort of build up. You go back to these early scenes. I mean, you've got two, polar opposite characters, and it's set up beautifully. He's from, Podunk Town. She's a big city girl. And he comes in, and it's very classic, which I always love. The FBI guy, is like, hey, have you ever, done a missing persons case? Of course not. We wouldn't have this film if you did. Have you ever been to New York? Of course not. And that's what immediately, we know we've got conflict inherent in that. He's going to the outsider. He's the small town guy. But I think going back to when you talked about performance, part of what makes Sutherland's performance so great and so incredible, we do see him, like us, being a voyeur. I mean, and we could go into that, of course. He, the camera, us, we're all watching this gorgeous woman, undressing, doing things, being vulnerable in all these situations. And he could come off creepy. He could come off seedy or creepy, I think. Had it not been for this very understated, genuine, kind of performance where he combines this sort of small town naivete in a way, but really solid, strong, sharp, astute as well. There's this combination. He comes off very strong to me. And yet he's got this, like I say, this outsider, small town, sort of, green setup. But he, there's a genuineness there, both in the character and in his performance, that I think, makes us embrace him so quickly. And makes her, ultimately, embrace him.
Yeah, and I think that also when it comes to Clute, I think that people very much default to this. That's the Jane Fonda movie. She won an Oscar for it. That's where she played the prostitute. And I think that somehow the brilliance of Donald Sutherland's performance is you know, it's been underrated. It's sort of been maybe not lost in the shuffle per se, but maybe just not as much attention paid to it. And I think that when an actor, for me, when an actor is able to do stuff with less is more,
yeah,
that is when I get really excited about a performance and I can really invest myself in the work because I'm never really distracted by anything big or large. And I'm not saying that big movie star performances aren't great. They are. That's not really what was called for here. And one of the things that I think that is a common thread all throughout Alan Pakula's body of work is a general sense of intelligence for people, action, if there was action, quote unquote, in his films, it was always motivated by character, by reasonable plotting, by something tangible that one could very much believe in. He certainly would not have been a choice director during, like, you know, the superhero years, as, you know, we probably call it now. I think that, you know, his style and his sensibility was very much attuned to the types of films that were getting made in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, and I think of movies like, you know, sort of like the films they don't make these days unless they're based on a bestseller or something like that. But, like, you know, Presumed Innocent or, you know, which was based on a book, obviously. But some of the more... consenting adults, some of the more highbrow, slickly made, but still provocative on an ideas level. That's the thing that's always intrigued me about Pakula's work. He's always a capable craftsman. His movies always look great, clearly working with Gordon Willis, you know, developing that bond, that director cinematographer bond. But the things that's always struck me about, his work, and I haven't seen all of his movies, and I'm very much looking forward to catching up with more. I just watched, in fact, last night, Rollover, the Jane Fonda, Chris Christopherson financial movie, which was a lot better than I had been led to believe. The reviews back in the day weren't very kind, but I feel like it's a movie that's aged really well. I told Frank earlier this morning, it reminded me of Sidney Lumet's movie Power, which is all about the media and, an election. And I think it was sort of, it was stepped on by critics mostly back in the day, maybe for being too cynical or, but I feel like kind of it's a kind of movie ahead of its time. I don't want to spoil Rollover for people who haven't seen it. A search online will yield some pleasant results. I will just say that, because I think it is a tougher movie to find. But Pakula's work in general for me just hits all those right notes of class, of intelligence, never treating your audience like an idiot. And delivering movies that just had a distinct personality. They were low key about it.
Yeah, and there's a humanism to them.
Definitely.
And I think that's an element that comes through in this film. You brought up Presumed Innocent, and yes, it's an adaptation, but the fact that he was attracted to it, he chose to do it, and the way he did it, even in that film, there's some loads of sort of moral ambiguity and characters who, you know, seem decent but make some bad choices or difficult choices, yeah, that are hard for us to call heroic, and yet we care. You know, we care about them. And I think I did read something somewhere once about, maybe it was an interview with him, talking about not a big fan of, like, you know, you mentioned superhero movies, not being a big fan of, you know, heroes and villains, and being much more attracted to having all characters have, good and bad, and, you know, and just sort of, I mean, I guess, you know, if you think about 70s films, of course, there's that whole, you know, it's a period there, like this film, where there is this embracing of, you know, realism, and characters that feel real, that feel lived in, you know, like you said, the sets feel lived in, the places feel lived in, the characters feel lived in. There's a lot of subtle tales in the film that just give it this real flavor of realism. And with realism, of course, comes ambiguity and comes complexity. So I don't know where I'm going with that, but yeah, and I think you see that in a lot of Coppola's films.
Yeah, I mean, if you just to interject, I mean, if you just literally look at the movies, I mean, forget about the movies that he produced, you know, which include To Kill a Mockingbird, and a bunch of other titles, but, you know, I haven't seen his debut, The Sterile Cuckoo, which I'm gonna have to try to track down. Klute comes on in 71, 73 does something called Love and Pain and the Whole Damn Thing, which I haven't seen. But then you get this amazing run of The Parallax View, All the President's Men, Comes a Horseman, Starting Over. Then in 1981, Rollover, Sophie's Choice, Rollover and Sophie's Choice, 81 and 82 respectively. A couple movies I haven't seen, Dream Lover, Orphans, See You in the Morning. And then the last four movies in the 90s, you know, the last film he did, and I know Frank and I have talked about it, you know, and it had all those production problems, and yet, for me, fantastic film, all about moral ambiguity, The Devil's Own, with Brad Pitt and Harrison Ford. Yep. A film that everybody fought over, and they didn't have a finished script, and they didn't like each other, and they reshot the ending, and I've always felt that the movie was fantastic. I mean, it's been a favorite for years. And that's a film all about shades of gray, and nothing is clear-cut in that movie.
Absolutely, and maybe that was, that's a perfect example of it, where, you know, there's so many reasons to have problems with Brad Pitt's character, and yet the way he's, you know, the backstory, the, you know, the nuance, the, just the way he's set up and developed, that even Harrison Ford's character feels for him. When he discovers, you know, I haven't seen it in a while, but, you know, he discovers...
He has to do what he has to do, but he knows what he has to do, but he's not happy about it. And he's also gone through the subplot with his partner and the killing of the guy. And the Devil's Own was sort of like almost a Sidney Lumet film as well. Like, it almost feels like a movie that Lumet could have directed too, but it still has that, that Pakula vibe, definitely. And I think Gordon Willis shot that too.
But that perfect example of not clear cut good guys and bad guys and heroes and villains. Yeah. But, I'm interested in hearing about going back to Klute. I'm interested in hearing about, you know, what you guys think. I mean, I have a lot of thoughts about just, you know, a bunch of things. Just the romance, that relationship. You know, what do you have to say about it? I'm curious what you guys think, because that's a big part of the film for me.
In a film that's so dark and perverse and transgressive at times, there's the scene where they're at the fruit market together.
Favorite. Absolutely.
And he's picking fruit, he's smelling the peaches, and she's bumping into him, and she's falling in love with him.
Absolutely, Frank.
And you're watching her fall in love with him, and it's almost a time capsule moment of the film that removes you from all the grime and the dirtiness of the film, and it is this very sweet and pure moment. And that is one of my favorite aspects of the film, is that scene right there.
I'm so excited you're bringing that up, because that is one of my favorite scenes. I'm excited that you're bringing it up. But
yeah, just how she, you know, she's like kissing his shoulder, he's got his jacket on, and then they're walking away, and she grabs the back of his jacket. And it's just... it's a real life moment.
Oh God! When she grabbed, well, first of all, when she's standing there, here's one of the little details that just kills me. Is when she's standing there, when he's picking out, he's picking the peaches and he's putting stuff in the bags, and it's all very warm, it's all very intimate. But there's a father with a kid over his shoulders. You remember that moment? Do you remember when she's standing?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a father with a kid over his shoulders, and she looks at this. She looks at them, you know, for a moment, the baby sitting on the father's shoulder. I always get the feeling like, you know, again, we have, you know, there's a lot we haven't talked about, but we do get a lot of backstory, not just because she's a call girl, but also that, you know, we get this inside view of her from these conversations with her psychiatrist, which I think are super important to know, that it's almost like this is the first time she's ever thought about, could I be a mother? Could I have a real thing with a man? And that's what I always get from that scene. It's because that's not just a random thing with this guy, though. You know, right? I mean, that's there for a very important reason. And I think it is to give us the sense that, this whole kind of, it's a very domestic, warm, intimate scene. It's probably the most intimate she's been with anybody in a hell of a long time. And more, you know, and I find it just absolutely beautiful. And that little glance up at this person, and she kind of, the kid, and just sort of, I don't know, it's so warm, it's so touching, it's so new for her. It's so new, she doesn't know what to do. She's almost fidgety. And I love that thing you point out when he walks away and she just grabs onto the back of his jacket. She doesn't want to be separated from him. This is the first time she's been all over these guys, but this is different. And that's what's key there. He's different. She's different when she's with him. This is different. Fantastic scene. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that their relationship is also, it's born completely out of the demands of the plot.
Yep.
So that these are people that probably wouldn't meet unless their paths had to cross because of the story. And I think that because of who they are and what they represent as archetypes, but then also how they transcend those archetypes, I think that there's a unique approach to how their relationship is explored. It's not the simple me cute thing and people fall in love. Like, their relationship builds to a certain peak, and it's one that's born out of a type of stress and a desire for help, as well as, you know, an interesting, you know, form of sexual longing probably. And I think that the fact that she is a prostitute and that he's a detective, I think that there is, of course, this, you know, there's the taboo element, you know, should he be doing this, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I just think that there's, as usual with the Pakula film, and especially with this one, there's nothing cut and dry about anything about this movie, including the love story. It's, the love story is as unique as all of the other elements are that make up the whole picture.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And I think, you know, when you think about it, and again, Frank and I were talking a bit, you know, when we were setting this up, about just the fact that the film's called Clues. And I get why it's called Clues. But the character that we spend time really getting to know internally, you know, backstory, you know, the day-to-day, is Bree, of course. And, you know, we see her going on these, you know, casting calls. We see her go to the modeling agency in the very beginning. You know, she's introduced, you know, she's in this lineup of beautiful women, you know. I love all the Gordon Willis pans that usually are like suspenseful and, you know, you know, something not good is going on. But here, even in the beginning, that same pan takes us across this row of women, and, you know, oh, she's too this and she's too that. And, she's got funny hands and her eyes are too big and she's, you know, C minus. And it's a brutal, brutal day to day life that she's in. She's, you know, trying to be an actor. She's trying to do something good. She's trying to use her talents in a different way, you know. And she keeps coming up against these walls. But she's, you know, and I think, you know, we get the, you know, we see these scenes, of course, with the psychiatrist that give us some hint into, you know, her internal life. And, you know, for me, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm a woman. I don't know. I can, you know, I can only see things from who I am. But I identify a lot, or at least I understand a lot, you know, that this depiction of a character, who's tremendously lonely. I mean, that's what resonates for me. I guess that's what I'm trying to say, that it resonates. That's what I get attracted to in the story and in her, that she's this really lonely but talented person. And so when he comes into her life, yes, and it's, you know, come through the plot, but it's because of this tremendous characterization and the setup, that his goodness is what's so attractive, his protectiveness, you know, his genuine caring that she's so starved for. There's that wonderful contrast, you know, we see her with this John in the beginning, and she's like, you know, faking all this orgasmic, you know, joy, and then she looks at her watch,
yeah.
You know, which has been, you know, we've seen that kind of thing, but somehow it just works so well here. There's those little moments of, you know, just self-awareness on her part, you know, like, it's just, and she looks at the watch, and it's all, you know, it's this whole phony kind of, you know, experience. And then, you know, then we see her with him, you know, and it's very, very different. And of course, that's not enough. What really cements it, what I think really shows us how different it is that she's so afraid of it. You know, she sabotages it, which is so, again, it's understanding human nature. It's understanding, you know, the reality of relationships. She sabotages it, you know, right? It's right after they get close that she, you know, tries to destroy it. So, and, you know, of course, she shares all that insight with her psychiatrist. But, you know, it's like you said before, too, it's, you know, very complex. It's very layered in the middle of a thriller.
Yeah, and, you know, it goes without saying, you know, Jane Fonda's performance in the movie is, you know, it's amazing. I mean, and, you know, if Donald Sutherland is sort of like the quiet anchor to the movie, you know, Jane Fonda is this, you know, and again, like I said before, nobody really goes over the top. Everything is played so believable, but there is this intensity to her. And, you know, like you said, Francine, just the way that, you know, she sort of took a cliche, you know, a prostitute cliche like that, and sort of just like, you know, did exactly what a great actor or actress would do with a moment like that. They would make it their own. And I think that when you look at her work, especially in the 70s, which really seems just like, it's just remarkable, the movies, and you look at them on paper, like, I mean, it's just some of the best movies of that era, and that era had arguably the best movies maybe ever in the history of the medium. There doesn't seem to be a time in Clute where she's just not engaged and she's not 100% wrapped up in the character and completely in the story. And I just, there's so few actresses, and, you know, and we've talked about this before, and, you know, actors these days who could fit these roles of these movies that used to get made. And, you know, I don't even know if there could be a modern day equivalent to a film like this with a performance like the way that Fonda did or Sutherland. But, you know, it's, it takes a great artist, I think, to look at stuff that's been done before and to really be able to put their own spin on it and make it unique and exciting.
And to make it, to go to those scary places. I mean, I'm in awe of great actors. And she goes to places in there that only a brave actress, like when I was watching it again, I was going, brave, amazing, so brave. You know, because you know, she's just going to these really dark, vulnerable places. And, you know, there's a couple of scenes I just want to mention. There's some really long monologue moments in the psychiatrist's office. And I was watching, when I was watching it again, I was thinking, you know, as a film actress, you know, of course she had to, you know, probably do these things multiple times, either in rehearsal or in different takes. In this final version that we see, you know, there is a sense of such freshness. And I mean, of course, this has to do with the directing too and the great writing. But there's a, in her performance, there's this freshness as if she's doing this for the first time and really, kind of coming to these conclusions as she's trying to articulate her feelings to the psychiatrist. It is just such good stuff. But there's a scene I wanted to mention, and it almost feels like, well, you know, why am I mentioning this? Well, I'll tell you. It's the scene in the beginning when she comes home and she, a few hits of pot, and she's in her little, like, caftani, like, red outfit or burgundy outfit, and she's relaxing. You know, she's got a big, giant goblet of wine, okay, remember? She's smoking some dope.
Mm-hmm.
She starts singing, and it's this kind of beautiful hymn-like, you know, prayer-like song, which we don't expect probably at this point in the film. I've seen it so many times now. It's very early in the film because all we've seen her do is, you know, negotiate half and half, you know, sex time with this guy and, you know, go on this modeling thing and, we haven't really, you know, seen the depth of her yet. And so here, what a great choice to see her just relaxing, and then she gets in bed. And she's wearing, like, regular pajamas, like old-school pajamas. I mean, all these little great details. And she's curled up. There's something real little girlish about her. Something like, okay, you know that call girl, that hooker we just saw? Here's something else, folks. You know, and I think the precision, the economy, the way he does Pakula, the writers of putting her, you know, giving us this other layer here is so beautiful. And she's reading some book about astrology. I just loved it. I just loved that kind of characterization. And of course, that's when she gets this first breather phone call, and then the camera pulls back real slowly, and you just see her looking really like a frightened child, you know, like a caged animal. It's just really, really good filmmaking.
You speak of the details of the film, and that's one thing that I absolutely love. And one thing that I don't know why I took note of this, but I loved it when I did, was throughout the film, whenever the camera pans past her kitchen table where she was smoking pot when we saw her at the beginning of the film, those candles are burning down. I mean, you only see her probably really light it at the beginning of the film. But as the film progresses, the continuity of the candles burning down was there, and I really appreciated that. I know it's small and it's odd, but I like that. And I just wanted to bring up something real quick, because you guys grazed over Donald Sutherland quite a few times in his quietly great performance. In this film, I think he's the definition of subtle great. And Nick brought up how he might have been overlooked, or maybe not overlooked, but kind of overshadowed by Jane Fonda's performance. Not to take anything away from Sutherland's performance. But I find that that's kind of his MO, unfortunately. And what I think are his best performances, Ordinary People.
Okay.
He's just so great in that. He's just so quiet, and he's just so deballed, for a lack of a better word, by Mary Tyler Moore. And even in MASH, I think he's phenomenal in MASH, but I think that Elliot Gould kind of out-hams him a bit, and he has the more showy performance. And I'm trying to think back to more Donald Sutherland performances, and I think that's him. I mean, he's always subtly great. Unless he's in some, like, Body Snatchers or Animal House or something like that, where he plays more of a, loud character, I guess.
Ordinary People is a good, and I know that film very well, and I use it a lot, and I adore it. And, that's an interesting example. Again, you know, in that film, he's very strong. He's very strong, but he does, it's in a quiet way. Similar to in this film. There's a quiet strength. Of course, he's a different character, but I know what you're talking about. He's very good at that. To exude a certain kind of strength and power without a lot of bravado and big moves, yeah.
Yeah, just to echo what you guys are saying, big fan of Sutherland in general. And I think that this performance sort of stands on its own in a unique way, because he took a character that we've seen before, the dogged detective, and he did new and interesting things with it, and the relationship that he built with Fonda, was certainly very memorable. Again, I just think that when Fonda's performance is so dynamic and it had so much buzz, I think that probably the subtle greatness of Donald Sutherland's work in this movie, we said before, it might have been a little bit overshadowed. But one thing I would love to bring up is the music.
Yes.
Because Michael Small, the composer, absolutely incredible composer. It's been awesome because, over the last probably year, I've been really immersing myself in more movies from the 60s and 70s. And, you just see the name Michael Small up and down. I mean, throughout so many great films. And this is such an interesting musical score. I mean, it's nervy. It gets under your skin. It really was very effectively composed and well used by Pakula in all the right ways. And, he did Parallax View for Pakula as well, did the Star Chamber for Peter Hyams, Marathon Man. He worked with some of the great directors, and I just, it's a name that I've really seen up and down through and through over the last year of watching a lot of these movies. And, and the film would not be what it is without that music.
The sound design of the film is...
Yeah, in general, the sound design, absolutely.
The sound design, again, watching it again, that would really... I've always noted the cinematography. The cinematography always stands out in those three films, that trilogy, we could call it, of Hoot and Parallax View and All the President's Men. But the sound design, it's absolutely wonderful. I mean, even that scene, the peaches, the fruit market scene, there's almost like a love theme music there, and it's so soulful and sort of bittersweet in a way. And then it comes back at the very end when she's leaving. And it just immediately conjures up that scene from the fruit market when they're falling, she's falling from, she's discovering something she hasn't had in her life before. And then at the end, when they're leaving, that music comes back, and it's just, it's like, the only word I can think of is bittersweet, because we haven't talked about the end, and, maybe somebody doesn't think it's bittersweet, but to me it is. But, I think, the creepy, eerie, music throughout too is incredible. And then I was just, when I was rewatching, because that one of my favorite scenes in the film, and one of my favorite relationships in the film, is the garment district, Mr. Goldfarb, the scene when she goes to visit him the first time. You guys remember that scene?
Yes.
And she goes, and there's that he puts it on. I mean, it's diegetic sound, of course, right? Because he puts the phonograph. He has a turntable, and he puts on that Russian music. But then it sort of builds into the score in a way, if I remember correctly. And she's walking through there, you know, with that, like, snake skinny gown with the, you know, wrap. And then she goes in there and, you know, yeah, she didn't get the acting gig, but she's certainly a damn good performer. And we see her, you know, we see her as an artist, you know, it's like her, you know, she's an actor within the story here, telling this tall tale about being in Cannes and, you know, the young count or whatever he was, and then the older guy who strangely reminds her of Mr. Goldfarb, and she always, like, you know, likes older men, and, you know, she's slowly walking around and undressing. What do you guys think of that scene? Because I think that scene is just, I'm going to just tell you before I ask you the question, and then we'll just say, yeah, you guys don't get to talk. That scene to me, because of the power of it, because she later comes back and tries to see him, which of course is where the climax, you know, with the, you know, the cable takes place. But you know, that it's another way that we get to know this extreme loneliness, this extreme absence of closeness in her life. The person, since her psychiatrist, who's a paid listener, is not available. When she goes back, I'm going off on 3,000 tangents here, keep up with me. But when she goes back, of course, the psychiatrist, you know, it's like, oh, I was about to almost kill someone. Well, you know, I'm sure the doctor will be interested in hearing about that. You know, she'll call you later. Yeah, that's so, yeah, so funny in a sick, dark way. But who does she call? Hello? Are you guys okay?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
She calls Mr. Goldfarb. You know, that says something. That says something about him, and it says a hell of a lot about her. She wants to see him. He's the guy that's gonna make her feel, less lonely, less alone. And so that, you know, thus that very long scene that sets up, you know, who this guy is and how she feels when she's with him. It's stunning. And then, of course, you know, the camera, you know, reveals later who's there in the dark shadows watching is Donald Sutherland's character. That's, you know, kind of interesting.
I love it. Because I think she's, you know, she finds solace in him.
Yeah.
And I also think it is a very nice way of showing that her character isn't necessarily as off color as she seems to be, or as she, I should say as she portrays herself being. You know, with her Johns, or even with her psychiatrist, or even when she's trying to, like you said earlier, sabotage her relationship with Donald Sutherland, this is her in her purest form, and I think that's her being real. That's the real Brie.
You know, and that's funny. The real Brie comes out with the performance for him. And that's interesting. And there's a sadness about it for me, because she's so good. And she's not able to get these jobs, you know, okay, I've only done these workshops, you know, hey, when you get an off-Broadway gig, call me, you know, or your hands are funny. She can't get these legitimate gigs, but we can see she's good. She is good. And it's kind of, again, for me, it just makes me care more about her. It's like, this is what she's got to do, you know, so.
Do you guys classify the film as a drama or a thriller? It's tough because it's like this movie, this movie is sort of two movies in one in some respects, and you could probably make the argument that it's a better drama than it is a thriller, and then in times it might be a better thriller than it is a drama in some weird ways. I think that that's one of the another unique element about this movie is that it definitely dips into the familiar beats of things, but it's very much its own thing.
I mean, it feels like classic thriller in terms of the suspense, in terms of us knowing more than the characters, you know, and us being worried about them and so invested. But I think the stuff that I walk away with, the stuff that makes me care to talk about it, is the characters, is these relationships, is what is, you know, what's it saying about, you know, being a woman, you know, at that time, you know, and that's why I think, you know, that's why I think the film's interesting for me. I think even, you know, just these subtle, smaller roles, like Arlen, is that her name, Arlen? The woman who's the junkie, that scene when they go to her, they go to her place to get more information. They're kind of going on this, you know, investigative journey here, and they're going to, you know, this mama so-and-so's, you know, various, places that she may be, and they finally end up going to her place, and she and her, you know, junkie boyfriend, you know, are just waiting for a delivery. That scene is so powerful, so well acted, so intense. And again, you know, it's such a well-crafted movie, because that scene at the end, you know, which is one of the most difficult, you know, it's a torture scene, you know, where we're watching her face as she's listening to the tape of Arlen, is that her name? I hope I'm getting that right. You know, being killed by Cable, and he plays that for her, and you're listening, and we're watching Jane Fonda's face just decompose and her tears going down her face, listening, and you know, as a viewer, that probably would have worked just that alone if we didn't have the backstory, but the fact that we met this woman and saw her pain and saw, you know, what her life was, which wasn't much, but God, you feel double because of that.
And it speaks to your comment earlier, Francine, about the humanist streak in Pakula's work and how there, you know, there was nothing really ever, like, you know, again, haven't seen all of his films, but certainly the ones that I have seen and the ones that have resonated with me the most. There's something cheap about them. Everything is born out of something that feels real. And he was attuned to all of the different things that sort of would go into a relationship, or a scenario, you know, that, you know, that's dictated by plot or something like that.
And right, and even that scene, you know, going there, you know, she's a junkie. You know, there's these moments, you know, when we're talking about Sutherland's glances and looks and how, you know, he's just living these characters, the characters so well that he doesn't have to say or do anything, but we feel what he's feeling. In that particular scene, there's a reaction shot of Breeze, which to me speaks volumes, where we just kind of see, wow, you know, she knows that she was, could have been one step away from this. You know, this was her friend, and look what road she ended up on, you know. And we get, in a very efficient way, Bree's world. And, you know, through this introduction of her friend, and, you know, waiting desperately for this fix. And then it's just a brutal cut where we see her washed up and, you know, like, on this boat, dead. It's a tough film in some ways, a very, very tough film. I mean, that torture tape, that, it doesn't matter how many times you've seen the film, and I've seen it many times. In fact, because if you have seen, it's one of those things where when you have seen something before, it actually makes it worse because you know what's coming. And, that's just awful. And Cable just stretching it out, And Bree just, who by the way, is called Daniel, and Daniel's at various times in the film. I don't know if you've noticed that, but she's got people call her Bree Daniel, and sometimes she's called Miss Daniel, and sometimes there's an S at the end, and sometimes there isn't. And I'll always wonder if that was intentional or just a screw-up. Watch it again and notice that.
I didn't notice that the first time.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting. How did you guys interpret the ending of the film? What was your feeling about the end of the film?
I thought that it was pretty remarkable. I loved it. I didn't know how the film was going to end with the story between Flute and Bree.
Yeah.
But as soon as it rolled, or I should say as soon as the final scene started, I had a pretty good idea of what was going to happen, and I absolutely loved it. I loved that they are not going to be together, but they're leaving together. I very much enjoyed that, and, call me crazy, but I instantly thought that Tarantino used that as a callback, for the end of Jackie Brown with Max Cherry and Jackie Brown, and I feel like that had a very, very, very similar ending.
I like that analogy.
Yeah, I didn't think of that either, but that's a good point.
With the phone ringing and everything, and just, like, it's this sweet romantic moment between them, but you know it's just not going to happen. But they both love each other.
The added bit of the fact that, Jane Fonda is certainly, her character is definitely not going to be, she's just not going to be able to live her life in any way, shape, or form the way that she used to.
Yeah, it's interesting because after, Cable gets out, he just kind of ends up going out the window, which is nice. It was better than having Sutherland have to kill him. We go inside her apartment, and then it's just voiceover. It's a monologue of her talking to her psychiatrist over the scene of them kind of walking through the apartment, and it's interrupted by the phone ring. Do you remember that? So, I mean, we hear her talking, she's saying, we have nothing in common, what would I do? I'd go crazy in a small town or something like that. And then the phone rings, and I think in more kind of conventional hands, in the hands of a director who wasn't as interested in reality, I think there might have been schmaltz at the end with her just looking at the phone and going with him and walking away. Like, mm-hmm. I've grown. We're at the end of the film here. I'm no longer that woman. I don't answer that phone anymore. I'm moving in a new direction. You know what I'm saying? That would have been, I think, the more kind of popular approach.
And yeah, it would have been a more conventional way to go.
Much more conventional, much more, hey, this is concrete. My character arc has moved in a new direction, and I am no longer that call girl. I love that it's just human. It's real. People don't change on it. It's more realistic. And she answers the phone. And I love that. Now she doesn't say like, yeah, I'll see you at 3:30. But it's planted a seed that we buy it when she says in the voiceover, which is funny and sad at the same time. She says, yeah, you know, I'm leaving, but, hell, she goes, I'll probably see you next week. You know?
Right.
And you don't want that to be the case. You want her to get out of Dodge. You want her to, like, build something in a, you know, cleaner, healthier. But you don't know. We don't know.
And there was such, and that's so true, and there was such this, seemingly this more open acceptance on the part of audiences to go with a film that doesn't have to have everything spelled out for you at the end, and it doesn't end with a big tidy bow wrapped around it, and loose ends are allowed to be left frayed a little bit, and, you know, I don't know if that just, it speaks about, you know, social climate and what people want out of a movie and what, you know, what filmmakers are interested in giving the audiences and what studios are allowing people to get financed. And one of the things that I've come across so often, again, over the last kind of year of just sort of delving into some of these movies I've missed and, you know, hadn't never even heard of in some instances, is the refusal to play it conventional towards the end, to allow films to finish organically in a way that doesn't require anything false. And, you know, that just doesn't happen these days. Everything now has to sort of, you know, the good guys more or less have to win, with few exceptions, of course. Everybody sort of has to be very well defined. You have to know exactly who you like and who you don't like. And it's just an interesting shift. It's very unique to, I think, to ponder about what it means for people and audiences and what we're accepting as, you know, the types of stories are being fed. You know, so personally speaking, I'm finding that the movies that came out of this time period, especially the 70s, they leave me feeling so much more satisfied overall, so.
Well, you know, and it's interesting. Well, you mentioned it before. It's really about an attitude towards the audience. And there is a sense of, you know, not dumbing down and looking up and saying, you know, there's intelligent people out there and they don't need to have it spoon-fed, meaning spoon-fed to them. They can ponder this. They can, you know, examine this. They can, you know, just disagree on maybe what the, you know, the story means and what it's about. Going back to what you said earlier, like, what's it about? And I think it could be about a lot of things. And I think this film is. And I mean, going back to just the pool of thinking about Parallax View and All the President's Men, you know, those three films in particular, I think about the endings are all, there's an ambiguity. I mean, of course, All the President's Men is an adaptation. It's based on real events. But in terms of how you feel at the end of all three of those films, Parallax View in particular, you know, you're pulled in different directions. Something, perhaps something good came out. Some good things come out. You know, All the President's Men certainly. But there's not any kind of weight lifted where you're going, all is good in the world again, you know, this romance is, you know, they're riding off into the sunset. I do think though, what's nice about this film and all the darkness in this film is that, they both seem to have been better as a result of knowing each other. And, you know, call me corny and romantic, but, you know, I guess I've been accused of worse things, but I think, yeah, I like that. I like that. I feel, you know, there's something positive about the ending. It's like, yeah, these two people, you know, in a way, maybe you could compare that in a way to Jackie Brown in that sense, you know, that same feeling. Like, hey, even if they never see each other again, they've both been, better off having known each other.
Oh, yeah, totally. And even with Jackie Brown, as with Clute, they both lead completely different lives that I don't know if their two lives would be compatible together.
But you know what's interesting? I'm thinking about, Jackie Brown, and here, you get the feeling that, what's nice is that while we focus on Bree, is she gonna, turn over a new leaf? Is she gonna change? Clute's never gonna be the same either.
Yeah.
With or without her. With or without her. And that's cool. That's very cool.
I think we're about wrapped up, unless you guys want to cover anything else about Clute or make any other comments.
Let me just think for one second if there was anything super No, I'm sure we'll think of things later because it's such a rich. But
you're probably spending a whole other hour on the Parallax View or any one of other Pakula's movies, in general. Yeah, this is always a pleasure, Francine. Your knowledge and passion for film is amazing and inspiring. And now I got to go watch all these other Pakula movies I haven't seen. And it's always a pleasure to talk movies with you because it's abundantly clear that you love them very much.
And obviously you do too. Both of you, and I love, it's just honest. It's a pleasure to talk to two knowledgeable, passionate film lovers who pay attention to all the details and nuance. Exciting.
Yeah, this was wonderful. And for everybody who's listening, Francine said she would come back again, so we're going to make a series out of this, and she's going to throw out a movie that we may or may not discuss next time.
Oh, really?
Depending on if plans change. Yeah. I thought you were... Do you have a movie that you maybe want to discuss next time?
Yeah, I've thought about so many. Every time I think about you guys and what you do, I think, man, I'd love to talk to them about this. And there's like a list of things. no, really. I wouldn't mind talking about, and this may change, there's two movies that come to mind. One I think I've mentioned before, and that's Once Upon a Time in the West.
Yes.
Sergio Leone. Because Spaghetti Western, Sergio Leone is a passion, and Once Upon a Time in the West is absolutely a joy, and would be a joy to discuss. Would you guys be up for that?
That's one of the best movies ever made. It's
great.
Yeah.
And then, going off, maybe because I think Nick just happened to mention Sidney Lumet, and I was thinking, God, when we're talking so much about performance, I love The Verdict.
Love The Verdict. I watched it probably about six months ago for the first time in a while, and huge, huge Sidney Lumet fan. That's one of his better films, and yeah, definitely would be a lot of fun to chat. Either one of those.
And series, we've got time. We can do others, but I'm leaning towards Once Upon a Time in the West. If you want to pin me down,
sounds good to me.
That sounds fantastic.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'll talk for an hour about how great Jason Robards is in that movie.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. So yeah, we can't go wrong with that. It's gonna be. In fact, just as a quick, teaser, I heard some sound when I was sitting outside somewhere this last week, and I immediately, could hear that, creaking, windmill sound that you hear in the beginning of Once Upon a Time in the West. I always go back, talk about sound design. I mean, that film is just really, okay. Teaser.
Okay. Awesome.
Love it. Can't wait. Well, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming back on. This is so much fun to get to be able to talk to you about film.
Thank you, guys. It was wonderful. Keep up the good work.
Thanks.